Hey, let's get started. I know. You're here. I'm here. You're there. All right. We got it. I want to hear, just give me a couple highlights. Remember this morning I said, if you open your eyes and you look for God, both in the place you're at and the people you're with, chances are he's going to show up and surprise you. Can I hear, none of you have been prepped for this. Some of you know I will call on you because I know you personally, Kyle. But let me hear some places where God showed up today, in even the littlest of things.
The inflatables.
The inflatables. You or the kids? Okay, you're that kid. You got kicked out. Give me another, something that was a highlight today. Where did you see God? Thank you.
KC's working with the children.
Right? How cool is this? Watching the KC's with the kids? Thank you for that. Three more.
Sunshine.
What? Sunshine. That's right. Praise God. Come on, sunshine. All right, two more. Yes. It's fun. It's fun to worship together, isn't it? Common unity. One more. I feel like that was kind of a mic drop, but I said there was going to be one more, so there's going to be one more. One more. Nobody wants to be that. Hey, Kyle, where did you see God today? What's that?
Wicked bingo.
Did you win? Cash and prizes? Big time? I'm so glad that somebody said, in the kids. That was perfect. You would have thought I would have asked you to do it. Who here has a child somewhere between the ages of 12 and 23? A lot of us, right? Is known as what right now? There's boomers, there's millennials. I'm Gen X, and they are Gen Z. In Young Life, obviously, we work with teenagers, and it's on us to really get to know the kids that we want to serve, want to walk alongside in life. And Gen Z has turned out to be absolutely fascinating. So here are some things that Generation Z is telling us, because it's one thing to learn about kids and do research and data and all that's good, but it's another thing to ask them to teach us about them, right? Because we're older. And again, we have boomers in here, millennials, Gen X, and this is a new generation. And then for those of you with younger kids, that's Gen Alpha. And we're just learning about Gen Alpha. But when Gen Z is asked, what do you think adults think about you? They say, adults think we are lazy, technology addicted, we are soft, we are overly sensitive. They know that we have thoughts about them, Gen Z. But Gen Z is actually really cool. There's a lot of things that make every generation unique from the ones that preceded it. All right, real quick, just let me see. Who are my Gen Xers in here with me? Okay, boomers in here. We have our boomers. Millennials in here. So all of you have key traits and markers about your generation that distinguish you from the ones that are after. Here's what's cool about Generation Z. So the people that myself and the others in Young Life work with, this is the first generation that is truly digital native. They would much rather talk with their thumbs than like this or like this. They're most comfortable, which is just amazing to us who are older. This is the first truly post-Christian generation where God is now much more of a concept or an idea. The most high-pressure generation ever. Here's why. When I went to Fayetteville Manlius High School and I played basketball, all I did was compare myself to the other guys at Fayetteville Manlius High School that played basketball, or to the other people in my conference. This generation compares themselves to everybody in the world. Think about that. So for them to be like elite is now normal. So it is just this high pressure generation. The most globally connected, obviously because of technology, there are 2 billion of them. They're gonna run this world. The first mostly non-white generation. And their driving question, and this is going to break your hearts, parents, the question that Generation Z is asking all the time is, am I safe? In any situation, kids are assessing for risk. Am I safe physically, emotionally, relationally, digitally? They're always wondering, am I safe? But what's really cool about Generation Z is there's these things that we as adults are like, oh man, that makes us sad and that's hard. But there's all these things that are also going to turn them into an amazing generation that when they have more power and control in positions, they're actually going to bring great blessing. And one of those markers is they see people in our society that would normally call outcasts. This generation sees people. The older we are, the more we're likely to see segmented populations within our population. But this younger generation sees them as people. And I know as Gen X, so I'm really a child of the 80s. The war on drugs, right? It was like incarcerated immediately. Good, bad. This is your brain on drugs. The Gulf War, the first televised war. I remember watching the Green Rockets. It was good, bad. It was them. The AIDS epidemic. Like, good, bad, it was very clear. I just remember growing up that way, outcast, outcast, outcast. You're in or you're out. But this generation, they see people. And that is a beautiful thing about our younger friends. Like, think about these kids that Casey's jumping around. They see beautiful people. And it's a reason I bet a lot of them come to serve, because they love people. So I bring up that phrase outcast because tonight I want to start looking at Jesus hanging out and interacting with people in that culture that would have been unbelievable outcasts, not welcome in almost any social setting and scenario. And I want to start, the first one is Jesus, all we know her as is the Samaritan woman. And it is a beautiful story that happens beside a well. In John chapter 4, it says, Jesus left Judea and he returned to Galilee and he had to go through Samaria on the way. This is important. If Judea is here and Galilee is here, Samaria is here. So you would literally have to go through it. However, Jews and Samaritans did not mix. They despised each other. Jews looked at Samaritans, they looked down on them like dogs. So Jews would literally travel north, over, up, around to get to Galilee. So that's important. Eventually, Jesus came to the Samaritan village of Sychar. A well was there, and Jesus, tired from the long walk, sat wearily beside the well around noontime. Soon a Samaritan woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, please give me a drink. Noontime, this is important. She's alone at the well, and there's a reason. Most women would draw water in the morning, A, because if it's practical. Depending on the time of year, it would be unbelievably hot in the middle of the day. But the other woman was practical for work, because then you'd have water for the cooking or the cleaning, the chores that would happen throughout the day. She specifically goes at noon. Now, the woman was surprised, for Jews refused to have anything to do with Samaritans. And she said to Jesus, she calls it out. She says, you're a Jew. I'm a Samaritan woman. Why are you asking me for a drink? Because the man-woman dynamic is also very different social realities, different rights that they would have as man and woman, also as Jew and Samaritan, the way they looked at each other. Jewish men would never willingly enter the presence of A, Samaritans, but B, a Samaritan woman. And here is Jesus, God with flesh, feelings, and a heartbeat, the visible image of an invisible God, choosing to enter into the place and space of somebody that his culture would have said, absolute outcast. That is a no-fly zone. So question, have you ever felt, think of a time in your life, have you ever felt like an outcast? I know some of us, it's immediate. Oh yeah, I remember when. I remember when they made me feel that way, when they called me that. Maybe from where you're from, where you are now. A lot of us can relate to the idea of being an outcast. Or being pushed to the margins, where nobody wanted to willingly enter your presence or space. Ashley and I, we have a story when, I think I have a picture of him here. So when Will was a little boy, he's now 22, but when Will was little, I was holding Will. He was younger than this. Ashley was holding Abby, and we were feeding our kids, and we only had the one set of twins at the time. Life was fairly manageable. And I remember I'm rocking Abby after I'm holding her. I mean, what do you think? Like 18 months old? I'm asking my wife, do you want to tell this story? No, younger. Okay, about a year old. So I'm like holding, rocking Abby. And she's feeding Will, and I just remember her like kneeling on the ground feeding Will, and I think it was like a chicken noodle soup substance thing, right, for babies. And it's been a long time. And I'm done feeding Abby. She's holding Will, and we're looking at each other. It's a sweet moment. It's like we're really good at this parent thing. Like, you got yours, I got mine. We're happy. But then I just remember watching, and Will just kind of pauses, looks at his mom, and just unleashes like horror movie level vomit on my wife. It was nasty, y'all. Like, the tone in the room changed, and it was down her shirt front. It was like over her shoulder back. It was in her hair. It was maybe, just maybe, on her face. And he's just such a sweet little kid, but then he kept throwing up. And we're like, okay, like, we've already seen our kids sick. This is wrong. So we called the pediatrician. Pediatrician says, this sounds really bad. You should go to an ER. We go to the ER. They said, yeah, he's really sick. So they check him in. Abby went with grandma and grandpa. So they check Will into the hospital, and they're pumping him with fluids. And they said, we don't know what's wrong with him, but we're going to keep him overnight. So Ashley and I, we stay in the room. There was two of like the chairs become beds things. So we're sitting there. We're like, this is scary. This is hard. We have no idea what's going on. But we're here, our boy's getting hydrated, it's all good. We go to sleep. 2 o'clock in the morning, I hear my wife run to the bathroom, unbelievably sick. And, you know, I'm trying to, like, do the, like, comfort thing. And I'm like, do you think it's because he threw up in your mouth? Do you know, like, you okay? And then I'm like, okay, so Will's sick, but he seems to be doing better, and now my wife's sick, and I'm like, well, he didn't throw up in my mouth, so I'm going to be fine. And we go to sleep. 3 o'clock, my turn. So what happens, though, is the doctors, they said, okay, he's sick, she's sick, he's sick. They put a quarantine sign on the door, and they said, none shall pass. No one is willingly going in here, and Swanda's, you can't come out, because we don't know what's going on. And, you know, it was like only to come in, it was, and obviously now we're very familiar, but it was masks and more, and it wasn't like NASA spacesuits or anything, but it made us very uncomfortable because we didn't know what we had, and we just knew that nobody wanted to be with us unless they absolutely had to. It was the first time, like, that's my most visible moment of feeling like, man, really nobody wants to be around us, and we felt very alone in our condition. It ended up being a very rare form of flu. It's okay. But I just remember very visibly feeling we're trapped and nobody wants around the Swandas. And I think of that when I think of some of these people that are outcasts. Nobody wants you. If we go back to the woman, it says, Jesus replied, if you only knew the gift of God has for you and who you're speaking to, you'd ask me and I would give you living water. So living water, remember, we talked this morning how using the pot, how we were just, hey man, welcome to Family Fest, there you go. Pete, I just, charge me for the cart. But we were designed for being filled up with him. And that phrase, living water, was significant because in their culture, the phrase living water, it would have been known as not your thirst, like the water in the well, but it referred to fill up from the inside out, to fulfill the deepest longings and needs of your heart and your soul. So Jesus is immediately going for it, and he's saying, no, this isn't about the water, this is about the living water. But sir, you don't have a rope or a bucket, she said, and this well is very deep. Where are you even going to get this living water? So what's cool is she doesn't know who she's talking to. It's really a beautiful moment. Put yourself by the side of the well. See yourself looking at a woman and a man who socially should never be talking to each other, and they're just having this conversation. But she doesn't know who Jesus is. She doesn't know that he calmed the storm from the boat with the friends. She doesn't know that he fed 5,000 with 5 loaves and 2 fish, that he walked on the water to his disciples, that he healed a blind man that called out to him. She doesn't know yet who she's talking to. And it's a really cool, intimate moment. Sometimes I think we forget who we have the opportunity to talk to at any given moment. We forget all the time because I want to take the power and I want to take the control and take the reins on my own. But I mentioned the blind man. Let's pause on the woman. I want to jump to this blind man. His name is Bartimaeus. It says, then they reached Jericho. And as Jesus got his disciples left town, a large crowd followed him. A blind beggar named Bartimaeus was sitting beside the road. When Bartimaeus heard that Jesus of Nazareth was nearby, he began to shout, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. I think this is cool. Really strange. Be quiet. Many of the people yelled at him, but he only shouted louder. Son of David, have mercy on me. I think it's interesting that the crowd is trying to silence somebody in great need that desperately wants to see Jesus. There have been many times in my life where I've hung with people that were holding me back intentionally or unintentionally holding me back from Jesus. And that doesn't change, gang, as we get older. There are people in our lives that they just naturally hold us back. Maybe it's our work colleagues, mom's group. Maybe it's our YMCA or our lifetime fitness basketball team. There are always people trying to keep us back from Jesus. It just happens in our culture. But Jesus hears him, and it says when Jesus heard him, he stopped and he said, wait, tell him to come here. So they called to the blind man. Cheer up, they said. Come on, he's calling you. Once Jesus stops, then the crowd turns and they're for him. Maybe not for the man, but they want to see what Jesus is going to do. It says Bartimaeus, he threw aside his coat, jumped up, and he came to Jesus. Same question as this morning. What do you want me to do for you? Jesus asked. This morning, what do you want? Another open-ended question. My rabbi, beautiful sign of respect in their culture, the blind man said, I just want to see. You know, I can relate to Bartimaeus. There's been times I've wanted to be healed, but I can relate to there's so many times where I've wanted to see. I have felt in the dark. I have felt alone. I have wanted clarity, and I've wanted to see. And Jesus said, go, for your faith has healed you. Instantly, the man could see, and he followed Jesus down the road. Same word as this morning, followed. Jesus intervened. The radical intervention of the incarnation, and they followed. This morning, he followed now. And what I love is Jesus sees people for who they really are, who he created them to be. Not in the condition, especially the older we are, that we see ourselves as and that we see others as. Jesus doesn't walk by in passing. He sees you. We need to hear that constantly, that Jesus sees you. He does not walk by. I want to show you a quick video that I love that illustrates this. It's a violinist. His name is Joshua Bell. So if you're a classical music fan. So true prodigy. He started playing violin at age 4, played Carnegie Hall by age 17. He now plays a violin. It's 300 years old, worth $15 million. But what's cool is occasionally he'll just pop up in random places and play, you know, so it's one of those videos. And here he is in a train station. He just throws down his violin case, doesn't announce himself, and he just plays. And I want you to watch the crowd. So Joshua Bell is one of only six people in the world that can play that piece flawlessly. Six people. But in that video, hundreds of people went by him, and only seven people stopped for an extended period of time to just take in the beauty of that moment. Hundreds. What I love is, I think it's just an example. We walk by people all the time, and sometimes I think we feel like Jesus would just walk by us. But I love in these stories, Jesus sees people. He sees the woman in spite of the differences. He sees this man who wants to see. There have been many times in my life where I have felt unseen by God. But let's go back to the well, because we're not done with the woman. And Jesus had just offered her living water. She said, "Where is this water?" She's curious, just like this morning. She doesn't pull back. Instead, she leans in. And Jesus replies, "Anyone who drinks this water will soon become thirsty again. But those who drink the water I give will never be thirsty again. It becomes a fresh, bubbling spring within them, giving eternal life." "Please, sir," the woman said, "give me that water. Then I'll never be thirsty again, and I won't have to come here to get this water." It's starting to click in her, this living water, something more meaningful and important than the water in the well. "Go and get your husband," Jesus told her. "I don't have a husband," the woman replied, and Jesus said, "You're right. You don't have a husband, for you've had five husbands, and you aren't even married to the man you're living with now. You certainly spoke the truth." Samaritan, Jew, woman, man. And now there's the issue of the husbands. And I've heard some people speak on this, painting the woman in such a negative light, as if it was her lifestyle. But in that culture, a woman couldn't divorce a man, which means she had been divorced, 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 divorced by a man. Rejected, unwanted, maybe widowed, but rejected. When I was like 8 years old, my biggest rejection story is part of my parents' divorce settlement. The magical thing was, we're going to send Andy to go live with his dad for about 10 to 12 weeks every summer. My mom raised me all the other weeks of the year. So I was raised by a woman, then I would have to go spend the summers with my dad. And my dad was a military guy, so he had basically 10 weeks to undo the stuff that my mom would do and put in me the stuff that he would do. And it was stuff I ended up hating. But his big thing was like, let's do chores together. Let's do jobs together. They had a property actually in Wisconsin. I lived in New York, but my dad, oddly enough, he lived in Duluth. And we would go to their cabin, and he said, "Andy, this is going to be fun. We're going to go do a project." And I'm like, yeah, you know, in my eight-year-old self. And it was something to do with water. And the hose was running from the house, and it was far out in the yard. And he said, "Okay, in a minute, I'm going to have you go turn the water on, okay?" I'm like, I can do that. Okay. So he's getting ready. He says, "Okay, Andy, go turn the water on." So I run around the house, and it's easy, right? Because you can only turn it one way. The other way is stuck. So I turn it on. And then I run back around. I'm like, "Okay, Dad, I did it. I turned it on." And he says, "Okay, doing great. All right, now it's really important. I need you to run around the house, and I need you to go turn it off." So I run around, but in my eight-year-old mind, I had no concept of lefty-loosey, righty-tighty. Sometimes I still don't, and I know some of you laughed. You're with me on that one. And I start turning, but it wouldn't turn off, and I turned it now so far on the one way that I couldn't even turn it off the other way, so now I'm freaking out in my eight-year-old brain because I knew my dad was probably going to be mad, and I get around to the side of the house. I'm like, "Dad, I don't know how to turn the water off." And I just remember my rejection moment was when my own father, who I share half of his DNA, and excuse me for swearing in advance, he goes, "God damn it, Andy, what is the matter with you?" And it wasn't that he was disappointed in like what I did. It was, no, in you. Not the water. I'm disappointed in you. And what I heard was, in who you are. And Jesus, again and again, he's bumping into people that are so broken in who they are. This woman was that kind of outcast in her society. But now, sorry, that's me and my mom. It really clicks. Sir, the woman said, you must be a prophet. This is where the full light bulb goes on. He's different. He is the visible image, God in the flesh. They continue to talk, and the woman said, I know the Messiah is coming, the one who is called the Christ, and when he comes, he'll explain everything to us. And Jesus told her, I am he. Finally, I am he. All cards on the table, and she sees him for who he really is and who he could be for her. An author summarized this passage. I like the way they wrote. It's as if Jesus is saying, I am he who loves and values you as you are today. I am he who will make whole all the brokenness. I am he who doesn't care how many followers you have or who likes your photos, because I just care about you. I am he who created you, and you don't have to change your appearance for me to think that you look great. If you're looking for the place where you will always find value and love, I am he. So put yourself in the story. If you are the woman at the well, what do you think Jesus would want to talk about with you? You know the state of your heart. You know what's going on at home. What do you think Jesus would want to talk about in that precious moment? Jesus calls you up off the curb on the side of the road. Jesus says, hey, what do you want me to do for you? You have one-on-one access to Jesus. What do you think he'd want to talk about? What would you want to say? When Ashley and I met, I think of relationships as a series of intentional asks. We met working at a Young Life camp in college. It's where the YL symbol is in the top right in the Adirondack Mountains of New York. And they had about 50, 60 high school and college kids on summer staff. And there we are. That was really nice. They think it's cute, honey. But there was a girl from Minnesota. I was the New York kid, a lifeguard named Ashley. I had a job that actually involved the trash. She had the cool job. I was like the trash boy. So we had a great friendship. There was some flirting. There was some liking. No, never acted on it, never spoke about it. But 3 years later, neither of us are dating anybody. I'm in New York working for Young Life, and she's in Minnesota, worked for Northwest Airlines. And we just start picking up a conversation. And one of us called the other and just said, hey, can you talk? And we start talking. And then we call back and we start talking again. Our long distance bills are going through the roof. The stuff that our kids can't imagine, like what's a long distance bill? Every night, 2 hours, 3 hours. And our relationship progressed because all we did was ask questions. Every relationship is built through a series of intentional asks. Right? And think about it, all the way to the day I said, will you marry me? That's how we move forward in relationships. But the very first one, and I don't remember who called who, I'm going to give you credit that you called me, that it was, hey, Andy, it's Ashley. Can you talk? What a simple, simple question. And it's kind of a theme in the questions I've asked you so far. What a great weekend in this beautiful place and space to say, hey, God, can you talk? There are some things on my mind. There are some things on my heart. We haven't talked for a while. I would love to talk. I want to come back. I'm going to close with our friends, Generation Z. They see people for people, even outcasts, people that I wouldn't naturally say, oh, yeah, just bring them on in. I've grown to as a Christian, but they see beautiful people that I would have considered outcasts. But then there's two more statistics related to Generation Z and faith, Generation Z and Jesus, that I find interesting. And they always beg questions of me as an adult. The first one is 38% of today's teenagers say, I believe Jesus is trustworthy, is worthy of my trust. And actually, I was encouraged by that. I would have expected that to have been lower. And 23%, about one-fourth of today's teenagers, believe that Jesus makes a real difference currently, is making a difference in our world. which always challenges me. Andy, in your faith, do you believe Jesus today is worthy of your trust? Andy, do you believe today Jesus can and is making a real difference in your world? As followers of Jesus, that is the continued challenge. Because I want to fight for power and control. And Jesus is saying, I'm here. What do you want? Let's talk. We'll pick up there tomorrow morning. Pete, can I pray? All right. Lord, thank you for my friends. Thank you for the gift of what we get to do together in such a beautiful place, such beautiful people. Thank you for the children, Lord. Thank you for their laughter. Thank you for the fun, the games, the swimming, the playing. Lord, we pray that you would just be present, that we would have eyes to see you, ears to hear you, and then the courage to follow you into the places and spaces where you call us. Thank you for tonight. Amen.